How do boys learn to act like boys? Is it something that just comes naturally? Or is there a process of learning, of socialization, that leads boys to follow along with stereotypically male behavior?
Our next guest is looking to answer those questions, and she sees a big transition in the 4 to 6 year old age range as boys start to learn how to fit in with their peers.
Judy Chu joins us now. She's affiliated faculty in the program in human biology at Stanford University. Her new book is When Boys Become Boys: Development, Relationships, and Masculinity. Judy, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, what, first of all, are the boy-like behaviors that we're talking about when we say things like boys will be boys?
I think usually parents and teachers are prompted to make that comment when boys act in ways that are rowdy or rambunctious, kind of that boy energy of being kind of frisky and out there and running around in large groups. That's usually when adults are tend to respond, mm-hmm. Look at the boys being boys.
Well, you wanted to find out where that and other behaviors come from. You followed a group of boys for 2 years, starting at age 4, and while each boy had his own personality, what were some of the common themes you saw from the beginning at age 4, at the beginning?
I think that, well, one of the more common things, it's not so much a specific behavior that they would display, although one of the things that they definitely bonded over was an expressed interest, for instance, in gunplay. Mm-hmm. And so whether or not the boys individually felt inclined to play with guns, they soon learned to say that they did like guns very much, because that was a very fast way to kind of bond with the other boys and have something in common that they could talk about and play and do their make-believe. It was more so in terms of the transition or the changes that I started to see as they, started to appear like quote-unquote boys. It was more about kind of becoming more constrained, being more careful about what they displayed. So whereas they had been very open and kind of honest, kind of wearing their hearts on their sleeves and just saying what they thought and felt in any given moment, it was more a transition towards becoming a little more strategic and a little more savvy, beginning to be more self-conscious in the sense that they were more worried about how other people might respond to them, if they were to express, for instance, an interest in dolls.
And now you talked to this group of boys over time and you tried to ask them and figure out what was leading them to change their behaviors. What kind of things did they say about why they didn't wear their heart on their sleeve anymore?
I think a lot of it was a concern about or a desire to fit in with the other boys, to connect with them in ways. They really wanted to kind of be one of the boys and with the boys. So this idea of wanting to identify as one of the boys as opposed to being one of the girls, or by default one of the girls in the class. And the other thing was just being able to relate to the other boys, to have things in common, to be able to play with them and spend time with them. And so with that goal, they were learning like what's appropriate behavior, what's desirable, and learning to align themselves with those norms that were appearing within their peer group culture and that also reflected kind of the larger norms, the broader norms in our society that our society has for boys in general.
Yeah, I was going to say it's there in the peer group, but where are these guys as a group getting these messages? Is it media, parents, everywhere? I don't know.
I think it's kind of everywhere. I mean, obviously there are some parents that, different parents have different preferences, and so some of them thought, gunplay is completely appropriate for boys this age, and they were okay with it. Other parents were very cautious and didn't really want their boys to play with guns. And so what would happen is when you get a group of kind of boys from different families with different values, the ones, who maybe aren't exposed to guns in the household, and I don't mean like real guns, but just kind of guns being okay, they would pick it up from their peers who maybe had, access to media or to messages that they weren't, that the boys weren't hearing in their own homes, if that makes sense.
And did the boys cite these things? Are they aware, I saw on TV or in this movie or my mom and dad said, do they have citations for this kind of behavior?
Well, they would talk about, like, for instance, one of the boys who was kind of the leader. He was taller. He was kind of more aggressive and more assertive. He would come in and say, you know what? I saw this rated R movie over the weekend, and there are these guys and the bad guys. They had these guns. And the other boys were, of course, kind of enthralled and kind of just like, what's going on and what is this about? And in part, even the leader, it was a little bit, the blind leading the blind, because he didn't know completely how to make sense of it. But he was kind of figuring that out by talking to his buddies about it. And what his buddies were picking up were like, oh, this is something kind know, interesting and maybe exciting. And obviously the parents, you know, or the teachers would respond in a way that made it even more interesting because they weren't really supposed to be talking about it. And so then they kind of try to hash that out. But because they're all 4 years old and don't have more information, they weren't always getting the most accurate picture of what was going on.
Are they, and this is hard maybe to see from the outside, how much are they taking this in and really internalizing it at this stage? And how much of this is posture, you know, acting, trying on what they perceive a male role to be?
I think the word that you use, posturing, is a perfect description of what's going on. A lot of times it seemed that they were learning to posture before they really understood what it was all about. And so the whole obsession or the focus on gunplay actually kind of petered out, because that was the year that the Jonesboro shootings happened in Arkansas. And when the boys saw and found out what guns could actually do, they actually became really frightened, and they abandoned their gunplay because they hadn't been thinking of it in violent terms. They had thought of it as, this is something we kind of do together. It's exciting because the teachers and parents don't appear to disapprove, but, you know, we can sneak around together and do it. But when they found out that guns actually hurt other people and could hurt children, and could, you know, they really didn't want anything to do with it after that. I mean, and so they changed to other things. They changed to sports. They changed to, you know, kind of baseball cards, things like that, other ways to bond that were kind of, that could still be, that were still kind of considered masculine ways of bonding, especially sports, you know, but without the violent edge that they had kind of been shocked by when the Jonesboro shootings happened.
How much of this, what they're trying on as masculine behavior, is really defined consciously as being not what the girls do?
Oh my gosh, so much of their masculinity, especially at that age, is defined exactly in opposition to what the girls are doing. So when they beat the boys actually created a team called the Mean Team, which they described as, you know, being created by the boys for the boys for the purpose of acting against the girls. So it was kind of a boys against the girls, but it also became very apparent that this was a way for them to define themselves in opposition to the girls. So they, when I spoke to the two boys who had began, you know, kind of created the Mean Team, they said, at first we thought it could be the nice team, but actually the girls are the nice team, so we had to be the Mean Team. So a lot of their self-concept in terms of masculinity was very much, you know, whatever the girls aren't, that's what we need to be. So defining themselves as the opposite or as being very different from girls and femininity.
And how much do the boys police each other's behavior, watch for the thing that goes outside that is too unboy-like or too girl-like?
They police each other a lot, even at this young age. I mean, the way that the Mean Team was structured, there was actually a boss of the Mean Team, who was his pseudonym was Mike. And Mike actually had the power to exclude people, because you could be fired from the Mean Team. And if you were fired from the Mean Team, by implication, you were no longer a boy, and you were by default a girl. And so there definitely were, you know, rules to be followed, rules that kept, you know, all the boys had to do this. And if you didn't do this, if you were, for instance, friends with the girls, you were at risk for being fired from the Mean Team and losing your status as a boy.
Are the boys just passively receiving messages from each other, from the world, about what it means to be a boy? Or are they pushing back sometimes, actively negotiating, trying to expand boundaries where they can?
They're absolutely active participants in their socialization. I'm really glad you brought that up, because there's definitely evidence of their resistance, a healthy resistance against both the messages that they're hearing that don't kind of mesh with what they feel about themselves or what they know about themselves, and also a resistance just against conformity. At that age, you get a lot of, you know, I don't have to do that. You can't tell me what to do. You're not the boss of me. And so that definitely comes up against this wall that they're approaching that says, okay, boys have to do this. But on an individual level, they don't like to be bossed around. They don't like to be told what to do. And so seeing them kind of struggle with that and negotiate that and having to kind of reconcile, or learning how to reconcile, you know, how to be a part of the boy group, how to fit in, while also maintaining their own sense of getting to do what they want and preserving their integrity in that sense.
At the end of the 2 years, a lot of people talk about, you know, boys being less emotionally connected, worse at relationships. Where did the boys you were working with stand after that period when it came to expressing emotions and expressing relationships with one another?
That's a great question. I think that what happens is, as they become more strategic and savvy, their relational capabilities and desires, what they're able to know, what they're able to do, and the fact that they want to have meaningful connections with others becomes less apparent, because they don't wear their hearts on their sleeves anymore. They don't kind of just come out and say it. But they don't lose those capabilities. The capabilities kind of go underground. They become more difficult to detect, but they definitely persist. And I also did, prior to my study of younger boys, I studied adolescent boys, and I definitely saw evidence in their interview narratives and in my observations of them in their everyday interactions with peers and adults that those capabilities are still there. They don't disappear or get lost, but they do become less evident.
We're talking to Judy Chu. She's the author of When Boys Become Boys. In just a couple minutes, we're going to follow up on that last point and talk about what might get lost when those abilities, those emotional relationship abilities and desires are there, but intentionally suppressed. She's in her book, she makes the case that boys learn the behaviors we consider masculine around the ages 4 to 6.
And you can join the conversation. Do you see boys changing their behavior around kindergarten age, learning how to act like a boy and not like a girl, as we understand those terms to be? Do you think there are built-in natural differences in the way boys and girls behave, or do they pick up those differences along the way? You can call in now at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We continue our conversation with Judy Chu, author of When Boys Become Boys: Development, Relationships, and Masculinity. In her research, she sees boys learning to fit in with their masculine social norms around age 5, and a lot of those behaviors are learned, not built in by nature.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Are you a parent or a teacher? You see this happening all the time in front of you. What kind of changes do you see, say, between ages 4 and 6 in the way boys act and interact? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll get your calls in just a moment. But Judy, just a few moments ago, you said, you know, boys don't lose these emotional interests, these relational interests, or even necessarily abilities, but they kind of hide them to fit in. What's the damage? What's the problem with that?
It's a difference. They basically learn that there can be a discrepancy between what they know and what they show. And what happens then is when they show less of what they know, people can underestimate what they know because they say, oh, well, boys can't do this, or they're not interested in, you know, they're out of tune or just not interested in relationships, out of touch with their own emotions, and they get definitely underestimated, and their relational capabilities go unacknowledged, at least in the literature on boys and also in their everyday lives. And that can be, you know, to boys' disadvantage, because people then treat them as though they don't know these things or they don't want these things. And then they can, you know, it just creates a cycle where they learn that, oh, well, this isn't something that I can share with other people, when those connections are something that they continue to seek throughout their lives. I mean, just kind of connections in which they can feel truly known and accepted. Unless they're able to share themselves with at least a select few, they can feel very lonely, and that can be very difficult, especially as they continue through adolescence and into adulthood.
We'll go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. We've got Jack on the line in Kenosha. Jack, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. Thank you for a good show. I'd like to ask the guest if she's familiar with the research done by the Discovery Channel and Discovery Magazine. They've been doing it for decades. One of the things that they found is that in boys and girls, the degree of masculinity or femininity in either sex is really determined pretty much in utero, and it's determined by different things, but oftentimes by chemicals that are used by the mother, and they determine, you know, whether, for instance, a young boy, I have a friend of mine, her young son was very quiet, very gentle, loved to read and fish, as opposed to, I knew a lady who had a little boy who had 3 or 4. She literally had to keep on a leash. This kid was the ever-ready bunny. He'd fallen out of the second floor and just kept on going. You have these extremes. And my comment about this is, until we begin to understand that and honor that, as well as honoring differences in sexual orientation, et cetera, we're really doing harm to people to expect people to all be the same and to fit into, you know, one nice square little box.
Jack, thank you so much. That brings up a lot of issues. Judy, where do you want to run with that?
I'm so glad you brought up that point, because I think it's a fantastic point, and I agree entirely. I mean, that definitely there are more individual differences than group differences. And so that's one of the things that people tend to not consider when they talk about, oh, boys do this and girls do that. Well, the differences among individual boys, as Jack pointed out in his examples, can oftentimes be greater than the difference between the average boy and the average girl. And so it really doesn't make sense to kind of pigeonhole people based on their sex or gender, because there can be a lot of other things that contribute aside from, you know, their mere sex or gender, their backgrounds, their family backgrounds, and their communities, and their race and ethnicity, and all those things can contribute, or even their individual temperaments and personalities definitely can shape more who they are than their simple category of sex or gender.
And Judy, you write that your own son was that quieter kid who didn't want to do the boisterous, rowdy boy stuff. How difficult is that situation, that kindergarten era, for somebody who doesn't want to do the traditional or stereotypically whatever boy stuff?
Right. My son was tended to be shy and quieter and didn't want to run around with, you know, he said that, you know, the other boys play a little rough and he'd rather just sit out. And actually at the school that he was at the time, unfortunately, they found that shyness and sensitivity in boys was a problem. And they would meet with us and tell us, you know, how problematic this was and that we needed to help him change and help him to kind of come out of his shell. And luckily, because I had done this work, I felt a little more confident staying with the idea that this was okay and just to let him write it out. And these days, he's, you know, a little less shy. He's still very sensitive, but he definitely enjoys being with his peers. And he just kind of needed to come out on his own schedule and not when people wanted him to be rowdy and rambunctious at that time. And so just kind of respecting each of our boys' own, again, like Jack pointed out, like their own personalities and temperament, and trying to meet them where they are and then helping them to move ahead and develop in the ways that will foster their own strengths, their individual strengths, and help them to kind of, you know, come into themselves in the ways that they feel comfortable.
Jack, thanks a lot for the call. We'll go now to Eva in Algonquin, Illinois. Eva, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
I wanted to bring up that, you know, in the earlier years when the kids have structure and then they go with their siblings, and that seems to be easier just from what I've experienced. And I work with pediatrics, so I find that with the adolescents, the trouble comes in with the bullies. Mm. It seems that when the boys are being bullied later on in life, or depending on their circumstances, it seems that they become more aggressive and more depressed.
Eva, thanks a lot for the call. Sounds like you were starting to break up a little there. Bullying, Judy, are you seeing that as early as 4 to 6?
Unfortunately, that does seem to be coming in at early ages these days. I know that the school my son was at, they had a big bullying problem in the first grade, which feels early as a parent, but definitely was coming in with the taunting and just kind of this one-upping competitive environment that the boys create for themselves because they feel compelled to have to prove themselves to their peers. And it's definitely a problem, and as Eva was starting to mention, it can lead to at least, you know, either aggression or have kind of feigned aggression and depression when they're feeling like they can't connect with other people and that their environments aren't safe.
Is bullying a big part of the story we're telling here? The bullies themselves are trying to display what they perceive as appropriate male behavior, and the people being bullied are those who don't conform to that?
I think that it's complicated. I think that in my book, Mike, who was the leader of the mean team and would oftentimes definitely appeared to be the bully. He would order other people around, boss other people around, and definitely had more aggressive tendencies. But if you look at his case study, you also understood that in many ways he felt very vulnerable. He was very vulnerable and scared of being abandoned, and that was why he had kind of wanted to create this team in the first place, so that he could punish anyone who wanted to try to leave him. And so I think each of the boys is trying to strive towards an image that they think will protect them and help to ensure the relationships that they want. They're trying to stay connected both to other people and to themselves. And in the way that their socialization is set up, you know, kind of emphasizing these masculine norms that emphasize physical toughness and emotional stoicism and self-sufficiency as the pathways to success, those are not serving them well in their quest to kind of have these relationships in which they feel known and accepted.
Well, looking at the research you did and the research that's out there, what kind of lessons can we start to draw for parents and teachers?
I think that in general, I usually suggest to parents and teachers who are looking to support boys, first of all, to acknowledge boys' relational capabilities as something that's healthy for boys, that's something that's going to be, you know, conducive to their overall health and also their success in terms of feeling connected to other people, feeling whole in themselves, getting to know themselves and feel validated in that sense, but also not necessarily pushing any one behavior or another. So my suggestion is not that we replace the traditional masculinity list with some other list that we decide for now is more valuable or better. Like, when we don't want to change, you know, replace the masculine, you know, the macho man with a sensitive man, but more so with an emphasis on fostering boys' awareness, their self-awareness, their conscientiousness, and there's critical self-reflection, so that sometimes if they hear messages that aren't consistent with what they know to be true of themselves or of their relationships, that they're able to kind of say, this doesn't sound quite right to me, and I feel confident enough to not feel compelled to kind of conform to these expectations that don't fit me correctly, that feel uncomfortable for me. So helping boys to stay in their comfort zones and therefore be, you know, quote unquote, true to themselves, and to find relationships that will support those efforts.
Is it fair to say maybe look toward, whether you're raising boys or girls, look for human qualities to promote rather than worrying about the male or female qualities?
Exactly. That's exactly right. And just to kind of, I think there's, Terry Real said that, you know, when we take the whole range of human qualities and we divide them into masculine and feminine, and we say that only boys should be quote-unquote masculine and only girls should be quote-unquote feminine, that everyone loses, because actually a lot of these qualities are human strengths, are things that will serve everyone well. And so if you can help them to be true to themselves, whatever that may be, and there will be, and to also account for individual differences, the fact that everybody does have different, you know, some people are more outgoing, some people are more shy, some people are more gregarious, and to kind of really figure out what each person's strengths are and help them to develop those in what ways you can, that's how we can better support our kids.
Judy, thanks for joining us today.
Of course, thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
That was Judy Chu. She's affiliated faculty in the program in human biology at Stanford University and author of When Boys Become Boys, Development, Relations, and Masculinity. If you have some more thoughts on this conversation, share them over at the Central Time Facebook page. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. My co-host, Veronica Rickard, will be back with me on Monday. Coming up, from death with dignity laws to green burial and closer attention to end-of-life care, the once taboo topics of death and dying are seeing a growing conversation. We'll explore that conversation with WPR's own Steve Paulson. Now, for the first time since the Supreme Court struck down the Federal Defense of Marriage Act last year, a federal appeals court has upheld state bans on same-sex marriage. Yesterday, the Sixth Circuit Court in Cincinnati overturned lower court rulings to keep same-sex marriage illegal in Michigan, Ohio, Tennessee, and Kentucky. This runs counter to the trend of appeals courts across the country ruling in favor of same-sex marriage. The ruling appears likely that makes it appear likely that the Supreme Court will take up the issue now that there's a contradiction among the lower courts. Last month, the Supreme Court declined to take up challenges to rulings in a number of states, including here in Wisconsin, making same-sex marriage effectively legal here. Central Times legal affairs correspondent Kimmy King joins us now. She's an associate professor of political science at the University of North Texas. Kimmy, welcome back to the show.
Good to be here. How are you?
Good. Well, this is the first appeals court in the country to uphold a ban on same-sex marriage. Did this surprise you?
Well, it is reversing the trend. And in fact, I think the thing that is interesting about it is that there had been such overwhelming support out of much more conservative regions in the United States, that is what is somewhat surprising. I mean, the 4th, the 7th, the 9th, and the 10th Circuit have all allowed same-sex marriage to go forward, and then the 6th Circuit comes in with this. And remember, there is a federal judge in Louisiana who had struck down, who had said that the states could ban same-sex marriage. I think it's also important to point out that Sixth Circuit decision is a 2-1 decision. Mm-hmm. And I think undoubtedly everyone is going to be looking to see whether or not the Sixth Circuit takes it up as an en banc review case where the whole circuit, all of the judges that sit in the Sixth Circuit, would sit and listen to the arguments and see if that 3-judge panel made the right decision.
What was the rationale from the 2-justice majority?
Well, one of the more interesting things about it, and you see this in the one judge's dissent who said that it reads more like a lecture on political philosophy, one of the points that was made was that because this is such a major change to how the states have operated in the past, that this ought to be something that we defer to the voters on, and basically made the argument for what we call judicial restraint. In essence, saying courts should not rush in where voters have already treaded. Now, one of the difficult things about that is that it's not just voter initiatives, but it's also been that courts have weighed in on it about fundamental rights. One of the things about voter initiatives that everyone always points out is that you have to be careful if you're talking about something that is a fundamental right. Recall that the South would have loved to have had a referendum on slavery, right? And so this concern that somehow the voters know best is always something that can create a concern if it's a fundamental right.
Now, looking ahead, does this mean the Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court, will finally take this up after declining to hear appeals in the past?
I think so. The only thing we know on this is that Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg had said there was no reason to take this case right now because there was no disagreement in the circuits. And I think especially given the fact that this decision came down after Election Day, it was the opposite direction of the other four circuits that have taken this up. It certainly is an indication that there may be a greater willingness to take this kind of battle on. So I think that's what everybody is going to be watching to see whether or not the court wants to sit it out and maybe let a couple more circuits weigh in before they actually take it up. But without a doubt, one of the things that the court looks at when it decides what kinds of cases to take is whether or not there is a split among the circuits. And right now we have a split, except you really basically only have two appellate judges and one district court judge going up against approximately 15 other judges that have heard this case. Is that a true enough circuit split? Not clear.
Could it happen that the Supreme Court takes this up, agrees with this latest court ruling, and then overturns all those rulings that allowed same-sex marriage in so many states?
Yeah, this is going to be very interesting because the court is in an uncharted area here. And it will be a very, I am sure that right now there is a conversation and dialogue going on at the Supreme Court about how to handle this, because in the Windsor and the Perry cases, all the court had basically said is the federal government shouldn't get involved in regulating marriage because that's been reserved to the states. This is now different because you have states saying, yeah, and when it gets left to us, we are going to regulate it away. Understand that many of these initiatives were done 5, 7, 9, over a decade ago. And in that intervening decade, public opinion has changed. So I think that if the court does take it up, and I think they are going to take it up, I don't know that they're going to take it up immediately following this Sixth Circuit decision. They might wait for a couple more appeals that are working their way up in the ranks. But if they do, be ready, because what you will start see happening is there are going to be those states that pass new initiatives to allow gay marriage because public opinion has changed so much.
So what happens if the Supreme Court doesn't take it up in the meantime? Is it just a patchwork still?
It is a patchwork, and that's one of the things that is a concern that commentators are focusing to, is that you're really left at the mercy of whatever your state is about the kind of rights that you have, and that can create a concern. But be ready for this, because this is not just an issue about, I think, same-sex marriage. I think it is reflects a larger issue regarding federalism and the way in which the United States is changing and how we view the states. You know, it used to be that physician-assisted suicide, for example, was only legal in 2 states. It's now we're moving very quickly toward it being allowed in 4 states, and other states are taking it up. Look at these the elections on Tuesday, where you had 3 states in D.C. legalize recreational marijuana. I mean, this whole notion of a patchwork of laws in the area that states regulate is going to do nothing but continue to increase.
Briefly, I wanted to ask you, the Supreme Court announced today that it's taking up a challenge to subsidies in the Affordable Care Act. What's at stake here?
So I'm going to once again make kind of the same argument I just made, and that is what is at the heart in the King versus Burwell decision that is going to be reviewed by the court is the extent to which the federal government can provide subsidies to those states that don't create medical exchanges. And once again, we have this idea of how much federal, what is the scope of federal control? What can the federal government do to encourage certain kinds of policies? And then what are the limits of where the federal government can intervene? And that's in essence what that case is about. Can the federal government give those subsidies to states that didn't adopt medical exchanges? And so it's the first volley, I think, in what are going to be several launches of volleys on the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare as it's referred to, because certainly the new Republican administration has indicated that in Congress it has a mandate to try to limit affordable care. It's going to be interesting because this is certainly one of those areas that could be damning for the Affordable Care Act. And if the federal government was prohibited from providing those subsidies to the states, it would undermine the core base of Obamacare.
All right, Kemi, thanks as always for joining us.
Thank you. You take it easy, guys.
We've been speaking with Kemi King, Central Time legal affairs correspondent and associate professor of political science at the University of North Texas. Yesterday, for the first time since the Supreme Court struck down the Federal Defense of Marriage Act last year, a federal appeals court has upheld state bans on same-sex marriage. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. As a culture, we're seeing an upsurge in the desire to talk about death, from the act of dying to burial options. The death of Brittany Maynard last week is part of that movement. The 29-year-old terminal cancer patient chose when to end her life under Oregon's Death with Dignity law. Starting next week, one of WPR's national shows, to the best of our knowledge, begins airing its 5-part series on death. We'll be airing short pieces from the series here on Central Time, Wednesdays after 3:30. Steve Paulson joins us now to talk about the series and America's urge to bring death into the open. He's the executive producer of To the Best of Our Knowledge. Steve, welcome back.
Oh, it is always a pleasure to be here.
Well, do I have that right? Is this a death moment? We're more comfortable or want to be more comfortable talking about death?
You know, it is, I think. And you know, it's so strange because we all know that we're going to die. And yet it is probably the one conversation that just about no one wants to have, is to talk about death. And so it's as if there's sort of this sense now that we need to talk about it. It's kind of burst into our collective consciousness. And so you're seeing all kinds of things. You're seeing some best-selling books about death and dying. You're seeing this sort of upsurge in gatherings, public gatherings, where people come together to talk about it. There are death salons, death cafes. There are even death dinners where people come together. So yeah, it's definitely on people's minds.
So what is changing in our culture that's making us more open to this once almost taboo topic?
Well, there's a sense that that death has gone underground. That it used to be that, you know, we were, as a culture, we were much more exposed to it. And, you know, people would die in their homes. Death was sort of closer at hand. And now it's sort of been sanitized, you know, removed from daily life. It's, you know, it happens off in the hospital. And And there are some problems that come as a result of that.
Well, let's get into those hospitals and talk about the medical profession. We've heard on this show from a Dr. Atul Gawande, a surgeon, who's trying to help open this conversation about death. And you've got you're going to share a story of somebody who's looking at doctors yourself. Set that up for
right,
us.
Right, right. So we're going to play a few short excerpts from some of the interviews that we'll be featuring in our five-hour series on death. And one of them is with a filmmaker, Michael Bernhagen, who, along with his co-producer, Terry Kodzadal, they've put together these films called Consider the Conversation 1 and 2. And they're really about how doctors often avoid talking honestly about death and why this leads to sad and often tragic endings. And Strange Champs did this interview.
Well, here's the deal. I think it's really important that people recognize that American medicine's success at fighting disease and extending life has created a new problem. Where we die has fundamentally changed. Where did most people die 100 years ago? They died at home. Today, most of us can expect to die in a hospital or a nursing home.
Yeah, what are the figures? It's something like 90% of us want to die at home. I'm not getting the numbers right, but only 20% of us will be able to do that.
I call it the 80-20 rule. You know, the majority of us do want to die at home, and we do want to talk about it. But guess what? 50% of them are going to die in a hospital, 20% of them hooked up to a whole bunch of tubes and machines in an intensive care unit, and another 25% in a skilled nursing facility. So we got this big disconnect.
So there seems to be this mindset shift. Maybe we're at the dawn of it now, the idea that just because we can extend life doesn't mean we always should.
Right. And so there's this huge discussion about, are there better ways that that we could kind of manage that end stage of life? And, you know, when you think about it, death is normal. I mean, it to die is not a failure of the medical system, for instance. It's something that's going to happen to all of us. And so the question then is, what can we do to try to make that as good as possible? And then the other thing that I should mention is, I mean, there are financial repercussions mm-hmm. here. So often, you know, the final 10 days of someone's life in an intensive care unit, that can easily hit $200,000 or $300,000, you know, with all of the life-saving technologies that are thrown at people, and often just to extend a life maybe another few weeks or so.
This is one of those fascinating historical processes that we're in the middle of, because I don't think anybody ever said, hey, let's pay lots of money to extend our lives in a hospital bed for 10 more days or 10 more weeks, and yet here we are.
Right. And so, I mean, so part of this is having that conversation. Mm-hmm. I mean, being open about it, you know, sort of diving into this discussion that, you know, that most people want to avoid. And, you know, I mean, I have to say, working on this radio series has been really kind of transformative for me. I know for some of my coworkers as well, because it's not anything that I really wanted to talk about that much. And then suddenly, you know, doing all of these interviews, and you realize, wow, it's you know, it's not only revealing. I mean, you're going places you'd never gone before, but it's pretty interesting too.
Well, I think that takes us to your next story that you're going to share with us. Set up. It's a psychotherapist who deals with these issues, who really puts herself front and center in this conversation.
Yes, yes. So her name is Lonnie Leary. She has been at the bedside of literally hundreds of people at the moment of death. I mean, this is what she does for a living. She counsels people. She counsels families. And it goes back to a sort of a tragic personal experience for her. When she was 13, her mother died all of a sudden, and her parents thought they were protecting her. You know, they didn't tell her anything about it. They didn't tell her that she had a terminal illness. One day her mother's at home, the next day she's in the hospital and she's dead, and Lonnie never had a chance to say goodbye, and it haunted her. And they didn't give her information, and so she basically, I mean, it shaped her life. And she, years later, I mean, she went into this profession as a counselor, you know, helping people who are dying. And she had vowed that when it came to her own father, that she would be there for him. And so she said that she would, you know, she was going to do everything she could to help her father out.
So I closed my practice and I closed my university class and I flew home to be his primary caregiver. And we began talking about everything. I laid it on the table and I asked him very direct questions such as, where do you want to be? Who do you want to be with you? Who do you not want to be with you? Even what do you want to be looking at? What do you want to be listening to? What do you want to be smelling? And let's make a bucket list. We don't know how much time you have left, but let's make this quality time. Let's make this the best time of your life. Let's make it intimate. Let's make it rich. Let's make it authentic.
There's so much in her story that speaks to issues people are raising now. And one of them right at the end there is, you know, not fighting a struggle against death at the end, but fighting to make life as good as it can be until the end.
Yeah. And, you know, there's this phrase that a lot of people use, a good death, which is kind of a controversial phrase. I mean, some people don't like it. Lani Leary prefers an authentic death. And part of her point is that having this conversation about death, it's not just with people who are dying. I mean, she says we should talk with our children about it. And I have to tell you that, you know, after I did this interview, I came home and talked with my own teenage children. And, you know, obviously you do things that are age appropriate here. But and she tells the story of how, I mean, she has talked, I mean, not surprising given her profession, but I mean, she's talked with her own daughter since her daughter was the age of 5 about this. And then her daughter is now, I don't know, about 30 or so. She works in the Coast Guard and does rescue missions out in the ocean. So very dangerous business. And, you know, Lani is sort of worried about her daughter. And she said one time they had a conversation, she asked her daughter, so, you know, If there was one way you had to die, what would it be? And her daughter said, you know, I'd like to drown.
Wow.
Which, I mean, yeah, wow. And for Lani Leary, it was this moment where she thought, oh, okay, I don't have to worry so much about what my daughter's doing. She's doing what she wants to do. If it were to end tragically, you know, that would be the way she'd want to go.
Well, she's looking to pull back the curtains on death. And then the third story I have to share, someone who's trying to bring at least the thought of death into our living rooms.
Yeah, so this is, you know, sort of an offbeat story. So this is a guy named Chuck Lakin, who is a woodworker and a home funeral director in Maine. And he has a very peculiar specialty. He builds coffins that double as pieces of furniture, which then, as you might imagine, turn into conversation pieces.
Actually, I think the first coffin was sort of a gimmick. I woke up in the middle of the night, and the idea came to me, for one, you can stand this coffin up with 5 shelves in it. It's a display cabinet. You can put it on its side, and the first, third, and fifth shelves turn 90 degrees. So you can use it as an entertainment center. And when you turn it on its back, the 5 shelves become the lid. One of my friends has one of those in her living room, and she just loves having new friends over for dinner, because at some lull in the conversation during the evening, she'll drop in the fact that that's her coffin over in the corner, just to see what happens. You know, it always starts a conversation after the initial shock, of course.
Well, there's a coffin furniture pieces starting a conversation. Steve, you're looking to start conversations here on the series.
Yeah, and part of the point of playing that last bit of tape is these conversations don't always have to be depressing. Mm. They can be revealing. They can be transformative. They can change relationships. They can be funny at times. I mean, it's a difficult subject, no doubt about it, but it can be revelatory.
Steve, thanks for joining us.
Oh, pleasure.
That's Steve Paulson, executive producer of To the Best of Our Knowledge. You can hear the first installment in the upcoming series on death starting next Wednesday at 6 here on Central Time, where we'll air excerpts from that series Wednesdays at 3:30. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.